A man with a calm heart who lives in troubled times is a man who stands head and shoulders above other men. The question is, how do you get that kind of heart?
Steve Farrar has always been a warrior, straight up, a truth teller.
He was a man's man, but he was incredibly humble.
He had so much gravitas.
Speaking to over 50,000 men at a Promise Keepers event.
Authored over 20 books.
He's our point man. Steve Farrar is the point man.
Welcome to Sundays with Steve, a podcast designed to equip men with timeless scriptural wisdom. In today's episode of his series, Fixing Troubled Hearts, Steve explains why belief in the one true God is the only path to true peace.
Let's turn to John chapter 14, and we're going to focus over the next few weeks on verses 1 through 6. God is in the process of building. He's in the process of building you, and he's in the process of building me. There's always a competition that's going on, and it's a worldwide competition. It's the competition that different countries get into to erect the world's tallest skyscraper. A few weeks ago, the latest, greatest skyscraper opened in Dubai. Before this one opened in Dubai, the highest skyscraper in the world was in Taiwan. But now this new one in Dubai, it matched the height of the one in Taiwan. Plus, you could put the Eiffel Tower on top of the one in Taiwan, and then you've got the one in Dubai. 202 stories high. World's highest swimming pool. World's highest mosque. World's highest debt on a building. What is so amazing is not so much the height of these buildings, but what is amazing to me is the depth of the buildings. This skyscraper in Dubai that they just finished took them 5 years to construct it. But the first year was spent on putting the foundation together. Hundreds of millions of yards of concrete. 192 piers going into the earth at a depth of 164 feet. If you're going to build that high, you better make sure that you're going down to the right depths, because the foundation is absolutely everything. In John chapter 14, Jesus is talking to the disciples about a construction project that they need to undertake. In fact, all of us are in the process of undertaking this particular construction project. In John 14, the words are familiar. Jesus says to them, "Let not your hearts be troubled." Now, why were their hearts troubled? Well, in John 13, he had just given them some news that they didn't want to hear. If you played football at some point in your life, you probably got blindsided. There's nothing like being blindsided. Kurt Warner got blindsided this last week. Just got cold-cocked. And they had the close-up, and you can see him. He's just laid out, and he's just trying to figure out where he is, and he's trying to figure out what happened. The disciples had just been blindsided in John chapter 13, and it was Jesus who blindsided them. Jesus had been with them now for 3 years. These are just regular guys, just working class guys. You know, you got some tax collectors, you got some fishermen, you got some guys just going about their business, but Jesus called them. And when he called them, it changed their whole lives. Here they are with the Son of God, they're traveling with him, he's instructing them, they're with him all the time. All the time they're with him. Because what's going to happen is, and they're not understanding this, but he's going to go away, and he's going to leave his work and he's going to leave his ministry to these guys. He's teaching. Whenever anyone comes up who has leprosy, he heals them. If someone is blind from birth, he'll heal them. If someone is crippled, he'll raise them up. It's astonishing. He's only been with them 3 years, and he now tells them in John 13 that he's going away. This absolutely has blindsided them. Why would you go away? They don't get it. They don't understand it. Now, as we read the scriptures, we can see in hindsight what the Lord's doing. But they had no clue. Just like we have no clue in our lives. We're just living life. We're just punching in and showing up. And we've got our hopes and dreams and aspirations. And then all of a sudden, you get blindsided. Just like Warner did. You look around at the guys around you. Well, everybody kind of, you know, everyone looks together. Everyone's, you know, fine. Everybody's,
You know what? Everyone's not fine. There's some guys in here that have been blindsided in recent days and recent weeks. Some guys, it happened a year ago or 2 years ago. But you see, it happens. One of the challenges of being blindsided is to simply get back on your feet again. In life, you got to keep going. And when you get blindsided, you're absolutely flat on your back. But you got to pick up and you got to keep going, even in the midst of news that you don't want to hear. It's always interesting to me in Ephesians 6, it says, "Be strong in the Lord and in the strength of His might. Put on the full armor of God that you may be able to stand firm." Stand firm. So much of the Christian life is standing firm. But what happens in life is that when we get blindsided, we lose our footing. We get knocked down. And then the name of the game is to get back up and to stand firm. What you're trying to do is get your feet under you, and there's something else you're trying to do. You have this agitation in your heart, inside of you. When these things happen, it's hard to sleep. It's hard to rest. Jesus says, "Let not your heart be troubled, let not your heart be agitated." And then He starts giving me some instruction that has to do with building my foundation deep. A little later on in the passage, Jesus offers something that is quite remarkable. Verse 27, Jesus says, "Peace I leave with you. My peace I give to you. Not as the world gives, do I give to you." And then He says the words again, "Do not let your heart be troubled, nor let it be fearful." So in other words, the peace that Jesus gives is different than the peace that Jack Daniels gives. Right? The peace that Jesus gives is different from a hopeful peace that you pursue in pornography or sexual immorality. There is a peace that He gives that is not like anything in the world. It's a peace which passes understanding. You know what we're all after? We're all after hearts that are not troubled. We're all after hearts that are not anguished. Who wants an anguished heart? Who wants a screwed up life? Who wants to be miserable? Nobody does. What Jesus is saying to these guys in John 14 is that there is a construction project that enables us to build a calm heart, a quiet heart. Isn't that what we want? Peace in our hearts when everything's going crazy all the way around us. A man with a calm heart who lives in troubled times and difficult times is a man who stands head and shoulders above other men. Now the question is, how do you get that kind of heart? Well, you've got to build your life on bedrock. You got to go down deep. You got to put the piers deep into the ground. You are only as strong as your foundation. So in John 14, 1, Jesus says, "Let not your heart be troubled." Watch this. Believe in God. Believe in God. There are a lot of things we could say that we should believe about God and who He is. I want to give you just two things. Here's the first one. You must believe that He is. Hebrews 11, verse 6. "Without faith, it's impossible to please God. For he who comes to God must believe that He," watch this, "must believe that He is, and that He is a rewarder of those who seek Him." He who comes to God must believe that what? He is. He is. We are surrounded by this idea of atheism. There's a circuit of professional atheists. I went back and looked at a clip on YouTube from Ben Stein's movie Expelled, where he has the conversation with Richard Dawkins, the famous atheist. Stein's just real low-key, and he's just talking to the guy, not a big threat. But he's just talking, he's just asking questions. And so Stein says, "So you don't believe that the world was started by the God of the Bible?" He goes, "Oh, absolutely not. It's out of the question. Just absolutely not." He said, "Okay, that's fine." He said, "But when you look at the universe at all," he said, "you've got a great mind. Do you see any evidence of design?" He goes, "Oh, yes, I do, actually. I see design." And Stein said, "You see design in the universe?" He goes, "Oh, yeah, I do see design." He said, "Okay, so tell me here, if there's no God who was the designer, then what could it possibly be?" He said, "Well, it had to have come from another civilization." No, that's what he said. You know what he's saying? He's saying he believes in extraterrestrials. And somehow they brought seed to the earth. Well, then the obvious question is, where did they come from? There cannot be a God, but there can be another civilization. It doesn't add up. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Without faith, it's impossible to please him. For those who come to him must believe that he is. Flip over to Psalm 19 with me. Everybody knows that God exists. Everybody knows that God is there. The heavens are telling, now watch this, the heavens are telling of the glory of God. In other words, the heavens are speaking of the glory of God. The heavens are proclaiming the glory of God. Every time they send pictures back from the Hubble telescope, what an amazing God. What an amazing God. The heavens are preaching the glory of God, and their expanse is declaring the work of his hands. Day to day pours forth speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. You look at those stars, this is unbelievable. The stronger the telescopes get, the more knowledge we get. But watch this, verse 3. There is no speech, nor are there words. Their voice is not heard, but it's still revelation. It's telling us that he is there, and we know that he's there.
God invites us to look at him. He invites us to get to know him. God invites us to compare him to those things which we think are great. Isaiah 40, verse 12. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand and marked off the heavens by the span and calculated the dust of the earth by the measure? As we're reading this, guys, as we're reading this, you've walked in here, some of you, with pressures and stresses and worries and concerns, and you're not quite sure how they're going to get resolved or how they're going to work out. For some of you, it's to such a degree you might even have trouble tonight sleeping because it's just a time of acute difficulty and stress. I would invite you, as we read this description, compare your stress and difficulty and seemingly insurmountable circumstances to what we're reading. And calculated the dust of the earth by the measure and weighed the mountains in a balance and the hills in a pair of scales. Who has directed the Spirit of the Lord, or as his counselor has informed him? Who has ever done that? No one. We have tried, but it's foolishness. No one has ever counseled the Lord. No one has ever instructed him. Verse 14, with whom did he consult, and who gave him understanding, and who taught him in the path of justice and taught him knowledge and informed him of the way of understanding? Behold, the nations are like a drop from a bucket and are regarded as a speck of dust on the scales. Behold, he lifts up the islands like fine dust. The way you would flick dust, a piece of lint off a sports coat, is what God does with the great islands of the world. He just flicks them and they come into existence. Or they go out of existence. All the nations, United States, Red China, United Nations, all the nations are as nothing before him. They are regarded, I love this, this is just great stuff. They are regarded by him as less than nothing and meaningless. Boy, that just, I like that. For some reason, it encourages me. Verse 18, this is good stuff. To whom then will you liken God? Or what likeness will you compare with him? As for the idol, a craftsman casts it. A goldsmith plates it with gold, and a silversmith fashions chains of silver. He who is too impoverished for such an offering, for a gold idol, to buy one or purchase one, as they did, selects a tree that doesn't rot. He seeks out for himself a skillful craftsman to prepare an idol that will not totter. You don't want it to totter. It rocks your faith when you pray to the idol if you just can't quite get it level. You say, well, I'm glad we don't worship idols. No, but your front end can get out of alignment on your idol. Right? See, we don't bow before idols like they did in the Old Testament. We just drive them. And we just pursue them. What you drive is not necessarily your idol, but it can be. You've seen that and I've seen it. Do you not know? Have you not heard? Has it not been declared to you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers. This is really good stuff, I think, because it gives perspective. The people we think are powerful and the people that we think are important that have money on their side and position and network, they're not powerful at all. Who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them out like a tent to dwell in. He it is who reduces rulers to nothing, who makes the judges of the earth meaningless. Scarcely have they been planted, scarcely have they been sown, scarcely has their stalk taken root in the earth, but he merely blows on them and they wither. And the storm carries them away like stubble. To whom then would you liken me, that I would be his equal, says the Holy One? Lift up your eyes on high and see who has created these stars, the one who leads forth their host by number. He calls them all by name. Because of the greatness of his might and the strength of his power, not one of them is missing. Boy, that's great stuff. To whom then will you liken me? He asks us, he invites us, he challenges us to compare whatever it is that we think is powerful, whatever it is that we think is great, whatever it is that we think is majestic and strong and secure. He invites us to compare those things to him. And they're not lint on the coat. That gives us perspective. God is not like you and God is not like me. Isaiah 55:8. My thoughts are not your thoughts. My ways are not your ways. Do you ever get upset at God because he hasn't done it your way? You ever had a situation in your life where you've wondered where he is, why he isn't answering your prayer, why this issue won't go away, why it keeps coming and coming again? In your mind, you've got a solution that you know would take care of the problem. In other words, you have a way that you know would work. But you know, it says, my ways are not your ways. We get frustrated with God, but he tells us up front. He levels with us. God doesn't con us. He tells us up front, my ways are not your ways. My thoughts are not your thoughts. See, God has things that he's doing. God has things that he's working. God has things that he is moving around and shaping and putting together that we know absolutely nothing about. The guys at MIT don't have a clue. They've got just a trace of what's out there about God. They've got just a trace of what's true about the creation that he has built and he has formed and the laws he's put into place. To whom then will you liken me? God says.
Secondly, you must believe that he is your father and that he is different from your earthly father. None of us had fathers who had it all together. Some of us had good fathers. Some of us had terrible fathers. Some of you guys were abused. A lot of us in here weren't abused. Some of us had fathers that were there for us and spent time with us. Others of us have fathers that abandoned us. None of us had perfect fathers. By the way, all the way in the New Testament, Jesus talks about the Father. Do you know John 13:17? The word Father is used 53 times to describe God. 53 times. If you're troubled, you got a heart that's just agitated, you're going through stuff, believe that he is your Father. Not like your earthly father. He is your father. He is good. He is perfect. He is just. He is loving. He is merciful. He is near to the brokenhearted. He saves those who are crushed in spirit. Our great father has been ministering to crushed men and women for thousands and thousands of years. You must believe that he is. And who is he? He's your father. I was reading a book this week by Paul Vitz on atheism. Paul Vitz, as a young man, was an atheist, but at the age of 35, he found the Lord. Vitz has done a survey of famous atheists throughout history. And one of the things that's so interesting is when you delve into their family background, there's not a one of them that has a good, healthy, loving, affectionate, disciplined relationship with their earthly father. There's not a one. Something has happened in that relationship, which they have then transferred to the Heavenly Father. That there's such a need, there's such a pain, there's such a scar that they immediately transfer that then to the Heavenly Father. And then he goes on and talks about great theists in history. Great men who believed in God. And it's interesting, their family relationships, relationships with their fathers, not all perfect, but healthy. Healthy. Sometimes there are issues. It took them years to work them out, but they worked them out. They worked on it. There was a health. There was an openness. There was a give and take. It was not a dysfunctional family. Dysfunctional families don't deal with reality. Functional families deal with reality. It doesn't mean you don't have junk, but it means you deal with your junk. Atheism is not an intellectual issue. Atheism is a heart issue and a father issue.
I took a personality test one time and flunked it. It's a little devastating, quite frankly. What they're trying to do is they're trying to find out what you're like, and they're trying to find out what your characteristics are. When I entered the doctoral program at Dallas Seminary, we took 11 of those things. The guy who was head of counseling, he went over everything with us. And he was able, through those tests, to discern my personality and my strengths and my weaknesses. God has no weaknesses. God only has strengths. God has attributes. There is nothing in my mind greater than studying the attributes of God. C.H. Spurgeon, perhaps the greatest preacher in the history of the Christian church, got up in his pulpit about 160 years ago in London, and here is what he said on a Sunday morning. You guys with me? I want you to listen carefully to this, if you would, please. He said, "It has been said by someone that the proper study of mankind is man. I will not oppose the idea, but I believe it is equally true that the proper study of a Christian is the Godhead. The highest science, the loftiest speculation, the mightiest philosophy which can ever engage the attention of a child of God is the name, nature, the person, the work, the doings, and the existence of the great God whom he calls his Father. There is something exceedingly improving to the mind in a contemplation of the divinity. It is a subject so vast that all our thoughts are lost in its immensity, so deep that our pride is drowned in its infinity. No subject of contemplation will tend to more humble your mind than thoughts of God. But while the subject of God humbles the mind, it also expands it. He who often thinks of God will have a larger mind than the man who simply plods around this narrow globe. Nothing will so enlarge the intellect, nothing so magnify the whole soul of man as a devout, earnest, continued investigation of the great subject of the deity." One more paragraph. "Would you lose your sorrow? Would you drown your cares? Then go and plunge yourself in the Godhead's deepest sea. Be lost in his immensity, and you shall come forth as from a couch of rest, refreshed and invigorated. I know nothing which can so comfort our souls, so calm the swelling billows of sorrow and grief, so speak peace to the winds of trial, as a devout musing on the subject of the Godhead. It is to that subject that I invite you this morning." He was 20 years old.
What's going to calm your heart? You believe that he is. You believe that he is. Can I finish by telling you a story? 1982 was one of the worst years of my life, probably the worst year of my life. And the reason I know that it's 1982 is that every time I pull out my American Express card, it says on there, remember since 1982. And the thing I remember about that, I was in the absolute worst shape financially I'd ever been in my life, and I got in the mail an American Express gold card saying, because of your financial responsibility. And I laughed. I was just trying to make it. Somehow they got me on a list and they sent me this. And so whenever I see that card 82, I remember that year. It was a horrific year. All my plans and hopes and dreams of ministry, just, they were gone. It's a long story. God needed to do some work in my life. And so my goals, and you know what? My happiness was gone. And what I wanted to achieve and accomplish, it was over. And God took me through a period of time for about 3 years where I went through a very, very deep depression. And my heart was troubled. I thought I was pretty mature for my age, and I was extremely immature because I didn't have my pilings down deep. I had a lot of trouble sleeping at night because I'd worry. I'd worry myself sick. And I had left one church, and I thought I was going to another, and then that didn't work out, and I thought I was going to another, and I thought I was going to another. And 7 different churches turned me down. And I wound up in this tiny little church. And the first Sunday I was there, there were probably 80 people, and I was 31, 32 years old, and the average age in that church was somewhere between 70 and 80. And it was my wilderness. I was there for 3 years. It was a very hard time for me. And 3 years later, God opened an opportunity, and we moved, and it looked like he had put us in a ministry that had unlimited potential, and things were going to take off. And I'd been there a year, and the whole thing, I won't go into detail, the whole thing caved. It just caved. It couldn't have been any worse. There were disagreement on some issues, just practical issues about ministry, and friction occurred, and we actually had to bring in a mediator to work it out. I was finishing my doctorate at Dallas Seminary, and I was writing my dissertation and got an approval to write about this new method of ministry that I was involved in and we were all working towards, and it was going to be the new model for church planting across America. And a week before I had to declare it and get final approval, the whole thing blew up in my face. I was devastated. I remember sitting on the front porch of my house and just, you talk about trouble, you talk about being sick. I could not understand why God had allowed all this to happen. I had to go speak to a group of men at a marriage conference about spiritual leadership in the home. And at the end of my talk, a guy came up to me and he said, what have you written on that? No one had ever asked that of me before in my life. He said, what have you written on this? And I said, nothing. He said, what has been written on this? I said, I don't know of anything. He said, nothing's been written on it? And I said, no. He said, okay. The next guy came up to me. He said, have you written anything on that topic? No. He said, can you recommend a book on it? I said, no. Because this was way back in 87, and publishers wouldn't publish books written to men in the 80s. Ask them. They'll tell you. They wouldn't do it. They'd tell you point blank. Because women buy all the books. If I wrote women's books, I'd be living on Maui. The guy says, what have you written on this? The next guy come up to me. He says, hey, have you written anything on this? No. I go, what is this? I didn't count them all, but somewhere between 12 and 14 guys in a row asked me what I'd written on this subject of male leadership. By the way, I had to have a new dissertation on next week. I'm talking to Mary on the way home on the plane, and she said, well, that's pretty clear, isn't it? I said, yeah, I think it is. I was in a small group with some guys, and I said, hey, guys, would you pray about this? Because I got to go get a new topic approved. And they said, yeah, we'll pray. So I come down to Dallas Seminary to talk to Dr. John Reed, because I got to sell him on this topic, and it's a big deal, and they got to approve it. We're talking, and he goes, hey, this is a great idea. I like this. Spiritual leadership, how a man leads a family. He goes, this is good stuff. He said, you know what you ought to do? You ought to write on this. You ought to survey. You ought to survey like 1,000 men around the country. You ought to ask them all kinds of questions about their leadership, about their families, about their ethics, about their... I said, gosh, I've never done that. He goes, well, you can do it. You can actually work with a firm, and they'll help you put the questions together and run it through a computer. And I said, you can do that? He goes, yeah, it's done in the academic world. It's fine, because back then people didn't have computers like we do now. And he said, they'll help you put it together. I said, well, what does something like that cost? He said, oh, you could do it for probably $15,000 bucks. I said, well, good. Maybe I'll do several of them. I love Dr. Reed. I thought he lost his mind. $15,000. I said, well, that's out of the question. He goes, well, maybe just think about it. Kick it around. We got a couple weeks here. We'll give you an extension. But as far as the topic, we're on it. We're good. But see if you can't figure out. So I come back, and the guys in the small group, we meet the next week, and one of the guys said, hey, how'd that deal go? I said, oh, it went well, and I gave them this idea, and they really liked it, but it doesn't look like it's going to work. Well, why not? Well, because this, you know, and it's just $15,000, and I, you know. Well, afterwards, we're walking out, and one of the guys hangs around, and he goes, hey, Steve, he said, you need to do that thing. I said, yeah, it'd be great, but I'm just not going to be able to do it because of the survey. He goes, no, you need to do it. I said, I'm glad you're excited about it, but I don't have the 15 grand. He said, I do. He said, do you know this guy? I said, I've met him. He said he was George Gallup's assistant before he started his own company. He said, call him. You call him Tuesday, I'll call him Monday, and I'll work it out. So that's what we did. Oh, by the way, where I was having difficulty in the ministry and wasn't seeing eye to eye with the leadership, we had to bring in an arbiter. Remember me telling you that? You know what we worked out at this little church? They said, you preach on Sunday, but don't come into the office during the week. We don't want you in there. Aren't you working on some paper or something? I said, yeah. They said, work on that. So I did. Then a publisher heard about it and said, hey, we'd like to turn that into a book. So I mentioned that to them. He said, yeah, just work on that. Just don't come into the office. That book became a book called Point Man. And to this day, and I say this to give God glory, guys, I cannot tell you when I was writing that book how troubled my heart was. Because every week I didn't know if I was going to survive another week in that ministry. Every week I was afraid I was going to get fired. I had no clue what God was going to do. My heart was troubled. I was worried. I was sick. I had trouble sleeping at night. I ask Mary. She'll tell you. And my prayer was, Lord, just let me finish this book before it comes to an end. I finished the book, and 3 weeks later, I got a call, and they said, we want you out of here. I've been in men's ministry full-time for over 20 years. You know how it all started? With me writing a book in a bedroom because they wouldn't let me come into the church. And that was very troubling. And it was embarrassing. Nobody knew about it except for three people in the leadership. But it was what we worked out. I look back on that, and you know what I see now? I see the hand of God. And that was the beginning of what God's done in my life over the last 20 years. So as I'm sitting here tonight, I look over the next 20 years, what's God going to do? I don't know. Have I got some things I'm concerned about? I mean, a little trouble about potentially? Yeah. But you know what? I believe that He is. And that He's a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. I'm telling you something. He's there. He's there. You can trust Him. Can I tell you something else? He's good. Oh, and by the way, those guys that I got crossways with, we got it all worked out. We got it all reconciled. And we just laughed at the goodness of God in our lives. A bunch of guys that didn't know what they were doing. But He made a way for us. So where are you? He knows where you are. Don't let your heart be troubled. Believe in God. He'll make a way. And He'll give you the peace which passes all understanding.
Thanks for listening today. This podcast was produced by Men's Leadership Ministries. We'll see you next time.